Commerce and Consumer Protection will come to order. It is Tuesday, February 10th, and we have just one piece of legislation before us, Senator Marty's Senate File 118. And Senator Marty is a member of the committee, for people in the audience who may or may not know that. So he will be able to make motions or on his own here. I know that there's a lot of passion about the bill, and probably on both sides, or more, maybe there's more than two sides, I don't know. But we're going to be respectful of each other, and I know people had to have tickets to come in. I'm glad that you all are able to watch from in here. We're on Channel 7, and there are televisions throughout the Capitol. There's one in my office, too, if anybody wanted to go sit down there and watch it. So with that, Senator Marty, I think we'll let you begin. I know you've put a lot of hours, a lot of weeks, months into this. And as I was saying, I know people have strong passions about it. We've had people from the city of St. Paul come to my town meeting. I see a gentleman back here now who came all the way over on a Saturday, on a very cold Saturday morning, to Brooklyn Center. And I appreciate that there's much interest in this. So, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. And yes, I would like to acknowledge the same, because I know there's some people who have come from a long way, and not all of whom were able to fit in the hearing room. But it is an issue that affects every one of us, and it's a key issue. And when you said it is a bill, it's a big compared to every other bill. We're trying to set up a health care system that works for Minnesota, and that's 1/6 of the state economy. So it's a major, major undertaking. And yes, it's a lot of work to get to this stage. We see it as a several-year effort to make it a reality. The Minnesota Health Plan is a plan. It would be a single plan for all Minnesota statewide. It would cover all people for all their medical needs. I think equally important, it would do much to improve public health, to prevent more serious illnesses through public health, through education, through prevention, early intervention. It would be a plan in which patients get to choose their own providers, 100% choice of the patients. They wouldn't have to worry about losing their health care when they lose their job, when they switch jobs, when they graduate from college. They wouldn't have to worry about whether dental care was covered, because it would cover dental care, prescription drugs, mental health services, chemical dependency treatment. We'd cover home health care, we'd cover nursing home care, we'd cover the medical care that people need. Consumers would use the same doctors, the same medical professionals, the same clinics, the same hospitals. The difference would be that the bills would all be paid by the Minnesota Health Plan, and everybody would be covered. There'd be no filling out of the complex insurance forms, the application forms. You wouldn't have to worry about pre-existing conditions. It seems everything's becoming a pre-existing conditions these days. No worried about whether the treatment you want is covered, because it's comprehensive benefits. The plan would not only end problems of access to health care due to cost, but also access problems due to a shortage of providers, which is especially critical in a lot of smaller communities. The plan would be funded by all Minnesotans. Premiums would be based on ability to pay. And this health plan is not cheap by any sense of the imagination, but it is less expensive than we're spending now. I'd like to start with a little bit of background on the scope of the problem. I think a lot of us are very aware of it in our own lives and in the lives of friends and others, but out of 5 million Minnesotans, perhaps 400,000 have no health insurance. They're totally uninsured. The only way they're going to get health care is going to the emergency room. Perhaps three times that many, over 1 million people, have insurance, but they're what we might call underinsured. They have insurance, but they don't have dental care, is a common one. Medical assistance covers dental care, but you can't get to a provider who will cover you. I'd like to explain what I mean by underinsured, because, again, over 1 million of our constituents are in that situation. I'll do so by describing a friend of mine who, 8 or 9 years ago, she was insured through her husband's job. It was not a high-income family by any means, but they had a fairly typical, she thought, health care plan. Premiums, I think they paid about $900 a month. She said the co-payments were about $30 for a doctor visit. They had a $3,000 annual deductible. Both of her kids were diagnosed with serious disabilities within a few months of each other. Something went wrong with her daughter. She took her in for an x-ray, showed a large tumor on the spine, and they quickly scheduled surgery. 14 hours of surgery, I think it was three surgical teams. Next day, while she's in the hospital room with her daughter who's recovering, a hospital billing clerk said she wanted to talk to her about her bill. She said, well, I've got insurance with whatever the health plan was. Got insurance for that, and the clerk says, yes, we know that, but the surgery was $130,000, and your insurance plan will pay only $70,000. So we got to talk about the other $60,000. She was insured, but she didn't have the health care coverage she needed. Lack of health care is causing many problems. The economic ones are most obvious. Personal bankruptcy, it's not only the leading cause of personal bankruptcy in this country, but it's the cause of more personal bankruptcies than all other causes combined. It's not only affecting individuals, it's affecting businesses. I don't know large or small businesses that aren't suffering with great problems from health care costs. Our school districts, every year the extra appropriations we try to give them are usually not enough to cover the increase in their health care expenses alone. Government, I think our state budget deficit is largely driven by, one, health care costs, and two, the fact that we failed to treat health care costs. I think our, you look at out-of-home placement costs that the state and county have, you look at prison costs, a whole lot of that is because people didn't get the mental health care, they didn't get the chemical dependency treatment they needed when they needed it. Last few years, I think the last decade, the growth in government spending in Minnesota on health care has been at 8.9% inflation rate. That's far more than everything else, and it's driving the system bankrupt. That's why we've got a big budget deficit. To tell you why, I think we have no choice but to have a major fix to the system. Last year in Minnesota, we spent about $7,000 per person on health care. That's pretty close to the national average. That works out to $35 billion a year in health care. That's what you pay, what the government pays, what your employer pays, everything combined, premiums, co-payments, prescriptions, medical equipment supplies, everything. $7,000 per person, $35 billion a year. If we can't afford that last year, the numbers the State Department of Health projections are for the year 2015, which is 7 years into the future from last year, that $35 billion will grow to $55 billion. That $20 billion in additional cost over what we could not afford last year is bigger than the entire state budget, which is $18, $19 billion a year. So the growth over what we can't afford now in 7 years will be bigger than the entire state budget. And the state budget will obviously be called upon to pick up more of that because others, more people, will be needing help with those expenses. Yet we don't do very well compared to other countries. Other countries spend, generally the ones that provide health care for all their people, spend about 40 to 60%, roughly around half of what we're spending on health care. And yet we're not getting better results. Our infant mortality rate is 27th among the nations. Our life expectancy is 20th among the nations. We're not the best. We're just the most expensive. And that's the economic cost. The human cost is atrocious. The National Academy of Sciences estimates 18,000 Americans die every year because of a lack of health care, lack of access to health care. That's six times as many people as who died in 9/11, and that hits every state. That hits Minnesota. We don't always think of it that way. The example I'm using right now is February 29th of 2008, Minneapolis Star Tribune. Minneapolis girl's flu death happened within hours. 12-year-old girl who liked to sing and dance. Seventh grader had asthma, but she did not get a flu shot because her mother did not have health insurance. So people die from it, and it's a cost that I don't think we want to keep. I don't think we want to keep sustaining that cost. Why do we have to have a change of this nature as opposed to what we've tried in recent years? The last couple of decades, we've been working to provide health insurance coverage to more Minnesotans. Every year we discuss how many more people we can cover, or in a year like this, how many more people we have to cut. And while we have had some successes, last year we added more people to Minnesota Care and so on, at the same time employers are dropping coverage because they can't afford it. So we're not gaining ground. I've been watching this for a couple of decades. I think a lot of you have as well. We're not gaining ground in covering more people. And we've tried, the other thing we've tried, in addition to insuring more people, is try to control costs, payment reform. We seem to have the hope that we can cut medical costs, which are too high, by spending more money on bureaucratic expenses to limit it, to control it, to measure it, everything else. Last year, the governor had a transformation, health transformation task force. One of the members of the commission, after the commission reported on how we got to do a better job of shopping for health care, created a new business that I saw billboards on it that didn't know what they were. Carol.com, help you shop for health care. It was a several multi-million dollar rollout for this new company. And I'm sure they do good work. I'm sure that if you need to shop for health care, that they can maybe help you get a little bit better deal. But the bottom line is this is an entire new business, didn't exist 2 years ago. They are spending, they will take 10, 15, maybe $20 million of health care dollars, and they won't provide one penny of health care. Every time we try and contain the costs, we put in more bureaucracy. We're now spending over 30 cents on every dollar on health care, on paperwork, excuse me. Tom Forsyth, human resource person at General Mills, described it. He said, if you tried to design a health care system that didn't work, you couldn't have done a better job than we've done. And that's the problem. We don't have a healthcare system, and we keep putting patches on a non-system, hoping that'll solve the problem. But before we design a system to fix it, I think we first have to figure out what the solution, what we're trying to get. What's the goal? Don't figure out where you're going until you know where you want to end up. And so we developed a series of principles to define what we think healthcare reform means. I had a bill a couple of years ago asking Healthcare Access Commission to look at them, design a system that would meet those nine goals. When we put together the Minnesota Health Plan, we put them in not as goals but as requirements for the health plan. And we always get into ideological fights around here about how we're going to solve an issue like this, and I think the best way around that is to focus on where we want to go and figure how we get there. The Minnesota Health Plan would reach these nine goals. I'm open to any approach that will meet those goals. I haven't seen any others yet, and I'm certainly open to it, however. Minnesota Health Plan creates a system that would cover everyone, it would contain costs, and it would improve health, all of which are what I think the goals of our reform should be. I think it creates a logical, common sense, and functional health care system, and I'd like to start in going through the bill by starting with explaining what those principles are, because they're all on page one of the bill. So now I'll just spend a few minutes, if you want, going through the bill. And here you see, as I mentioned, these principles are requirements for the health plan. First one is an obvious one, ensure all Minnesotans receive quality health care regardless of income. You know, all Minnesotans do receive some sort of health care, but if it's nowhere before, then it's the emergency room, it's the most expensive places. The second principle would be that you don't delay, restrict or deny care to hold down costs, but you do so through prevention, through efficiency, through reduction of bureaucracy. Third one, you cover all necessary care, including chemical dependency, including prescription drugs, including dental care, home health care, the full range of health care services. Cradle to grave, you're covered. You allow patients to choose their own providers. Most of us have some choice. We have some who aren't in the network, and we can't go to them. But this would give you total choice of provider. Be funded through premiums based on ability to pay. Focus on prevention care. I want to focus on two of the last ones that are often missed. On page 2, line 1, number 7, ensure an adequate number of qualified healthcare professionals. We have a shortage of many, especially primary care providers, doctors and nurses. We have a shortage of some specialists, like psychiatrists. We have a shortage of medical technicians, technologists. We need them. You can't provide health care if you don't have enough around. University of Minnesota, I think, provides at least 2-to-1 specialists instead of primary care practitioners in their medical school. We probably need about the opposite proportion of that. And as our baby boom generation is aging, we're going to have a crisis and lack of providers. So we have to make sure the plan provides enough providers. And the ninth one here I want to focus on is one that most people, most patients don't think about when we talk about healthcare reform, but it's to provide adequate and timely payments to providers. You can't run a healthcare system if people aren't paid enough. If they're not paid a decent wage, they're not paid enough to operate their hospitals. This year, because of the budget deficit, I think the governor's proposal and other proposals are to take a cut at the amount of money hospitals would receive. This is a time when hospitals, the uncompensated care, because of the economy, will probably double. And we're going to cut the reimbursement rates. You can't run a hospital system if you can't count on a reliable source of funding. Those principles, I think, are essential for health care reform, and that's what this health care bill is designed around. I'll go through the bill, the rest of the bill now. Section 2 is just miscellaneous provisions, some definitions, some conflict of interest provisions, data practices, rulemaking, et cetera. Page 4, we have the eligibility. I'll just highlight subdivision 1. Can go into more of this during questions if people want. All Minnesota residents are eligible for the health plan. The board's to establish standards to prevent people from moving the state for the purpose of obtaining medical care. I can go into that more detail more later as well. The rest of that article is simply talking about what happens when you are out of town, what happens when people are in the state that aren't from here, retiree benefits, et cetera. Article 3 goes through the benefits. It's a comprehensive list, a long list. I think there are 27 items on it. It includes medical equipment, appliances. Diabetics trying to get test strips, they're covered. Language interpretation, translation for healthcare services, immunization, hospice care, prescription drugs, you name it, they're all covered. There are some things that aren't covered on subdivision 4 has the exclusions, and the most obvious one would be cosmetic, purely cosmetic procedures. We already cover reconstructive surgery. That would continue to be, but purely cosmetic surgeries would not be covered. The bill is much more than a financing system. It attempts to address the entire system. On page 7, line 23, you'll see a prohibition on the health plan covers virtually, would cover all prescription drugs, except for those that are marketed directly to consumers. You watch the TV news, you watch, read newspaper and so on, you can't avoid seeing umpteen ads about prescription drugs, which are not a cheap thing. It's $100 million of advertising a year in Minnesota. $100 million of our health care dollars going into that, and on top of that, it's creating more demand for drugs that are not necessarily the most effective ones. But the plan, in effect, if you want to sell your prescription drugs in Minnesota, you could not advertise direct to consumers in Minnesota. So you would not have that advertising. The wording here, it's supposed to say direct, we market to consumers in Minnesota, but we will change that. Care coordination, section 2. The goal is here, I think it's been called other things by, in other reforms, medical homes or something. Everybody should have somebody to coordinate their care, make sure they get immunizations when they need it, make sure that they're accessing preventive care, that they're not getting prescriptions that conflict with each other, that if they need to know who to go to for some kind of physical therapy or somebody they know, somebody they can turn to. Article 4, the funding for the bill. This would be a Minnesota Health Fund. The board, it would be run by the Minnesota Health Board. I'll get into in a little while. But all money collected, you can see on page 8, line 8, all money collected would be deposited in the Minnesota Health Fund to be used exclusively for this chapter. The state legislature and governorhood have no say in this. The board would set the premiums, would operate the health plan. There's a reason I think we have to isolate it from politics. You look at every other country where they have a public health care system, they tend to not fund it enough because the politicians don't want to vote for tax increases. Well, in this case, it's not taxes. It's premiums that go directly to the health plan. We all pay them. It might be collected by the government, but it does not go to the state treasury. It goes directly to the health fund for purposes in here. The rest of Article 4 spells out what accounts are there. You'll see there's one for prevention. There's one for planning and assessment, evaluation. There's training, development, continuing education budget, because, again, that's part of what we have to do to make sure we have an adequate number of the right providers. Section 2, page 9, revenue sources, the board would establish a premium structure based on ability to pay. Businesses would have a health care tax. They would be, the plan would be that businesses are paying almost a quarter of the health care dollar now. Individuals are paying a little more than a quarter, and government's paying almost half right now. The plan would be to have businesses continue to pay almost as much. Again, the plan would be cheaper for everyone, including business. But the other thing it saves business on is the time they have to spend shopping around for a health plan every year, negotiating with the plan, and then educating all their employees on the change of stuff. It takes a good number of hours every year for each employee when they're switching plans, find out what's available. All of that would be removed from the responsibility of the employer. It would all be covered by the plan. It does talk about seeking waivers, exemptions, agreements, and legislation from the federal government to fold in all federal funding into this. And at the bottom of page 10, you can see no cost sharing. I can get into this more detail. No deductibles, co-payments, or co-insurance. The entire thing would be paid for by your premiums. Page 11, collateral sources. And this is of interest to the Commerce Committee, obviously. The plan would be that auto insurance, workers' comp insurance, the medical costs of those things would be covered by the health plan. However, if you're in an auto accident with some driver from another state, the plan would be collecting from that collateral source. But the bottom line is, I think Senator Olson told me that a whole lot of her clients as an attorney are people who were, whether they're workers' comp or auto accidents or whatever, are people who go to court because their health care payments got cut off. And I think that this would not only reduce the hassles, the controversy over workers' comp and auto insurance and so on, it would reduce the number of lawsuits as well. Article 5, the payments, the plan would pay, they would negotiate rates with providers. Bottom of page 12, they negotiate rates with providers, and the rates may factor in geographic differences. Normally, when the legislature has geographic differences in compensation, it means rural Minnesota gets less. In this case, the opposite might be true in many cases. If you take a general practitioner, they might be on call one night, two nights a month in the Twin Cities. In a small town, they might be on call a week or 2 weeks a month. It's easier to get people to practice in certain communities than others. The board is responsible for making sure we have adequate supply of providers around the state. So negotiated rates may mean you'd have higher compensation in some smaller communities. Payments to institutional providers, subdivision 3 on page 13, the board would negotiate annual budgets with hospitals, nursing homes, and so on. And the explanation of why this makes some sense is try and figure out how much time nurses and people in hospitals spend trying to figure out what gets attributed to you, how many doses of medication, how many procedures were done to you, not just for your charts, but they have to do it also for your billing stuff. And then you have to have people who bill and collect it and everything else. If we ran schools that way, you would have, say, a third grade teacher saying, this kid used this many markers and this many sheets of paper, and I devoted 3% of my time to this kid and 4% to this kid, and we allocate the utilities across the board and the janitor's costs and everything. We allocate it all to each kid's school insurance program and their parents' school insurance program, and each of those plans would pay for different things at different rates. Some wouldn't pay at all, and we'd have to shift that around. If you ran a school like that, you'd spend half the day trying to figure out who owed what instead of teaching. And I think what you want the school to do is teach. And what you want a hospital to do is provide health care to people. And so the plans would have negotiating a budget with the plan between the hospitals and nursing homes and so on. The goal of the plan and the goal of the hospital should be the same, and that is providing good quality health care to people at a reasonable cost. Governance of it, Article 6. The board would be run by, the health plan would be run by a board. I'll point out one good old thing in Section 2 here. The executive officer of the Minnesota Health Plan would be capped at the commissioner level of Commissioner of Finance and so on, 95% of the salary of the governor. I point that out because this is in here to make the point about, I think the Star Tribune had a thing on nonprofits. They were arguing why the Guthrie director was not overpaid. And the example, they say, look how it compares to other nonprofits. And the top nine in the state were all health care related. And the top eight of those were all over $1 million. And about top five or six or seven were like $1.3 million, $1.4 million to run a nonprofit health insurance plan. I think that executive salaries are very excessive. We have one healthcare company, it doesn't provide directly to anyone, but a lot of employers work through it, that paid its CEO $105 million a year a few years ago to not provide a penny's worth of healthcare, but to allocate who gets what healthcare from whom. I just don't think we can afford that. The Minnesota Health Plan Board, Section 3, it would be a 15-member board. Eight of the people would come from regional boards, one from each of five rural health planning boards, three from the Metropolitan Regional Health Planning Board. Those eight would then appoint others to include representatives of both consumers and providers of various types. The rest of that section spells out the general duties of the board. I'll mention one that is important because this is a major shift. And on page 16, the 13th one, create a program to provide support and retraining for workers dislocated by the creation of the health plan. Anything we do this year, especially, we see there's dislocation of workers. It's happening every day here. This is to acknowledge that there is a shift here. There are a lot fewer people providing billing. The directive is for them to focus primarily to the extent possible to address the shortage of providers and healthcare professionals. A whole lot of people who work in medical administration, whether for insurance plans or for hospitals and others, are already medically trained. Many of them are doctors. We need them practicing medicine instead of shuffling papers. Many others, people who work as billing clerks and so on, might easily be able to be retrained to fill in positions such as medical technicians, where there is a shortage in most hospitals and most places in the state. And as it points out, as Minnesota residents, all of these displaced workers would start with one less disadvantage than every current displaced worker has, and they'd all be covered by the health plan for all their medical needs. That's the biggest problem people have when they lose a job. COBRA is available, but 9 out of 10 people don't take advantage of it because they can't afford it. Everybody be covered. More duties of the board. Section 5 gets to the regional planning boards, which are designed to, they'd be operated by county commissioners. Each county in the region would select one county commissioner to serve on the board or a designee of theirs, and then metro area would be two per county. And then those boards would select membership, the chair from their membership. They would work with, as you'll notice on page 19, about halfway down, it would be responsible for collaborating with public health care agencies to implement public health and wellness, a heavy focus on public health preventive care. Example I like to use is that when I was a kid, polio vaccinations came into being, and I remember lining up in the school gym to get a polio vaccination. Nowadays, they're recommending all kids over age 6 months, I think, get a flu shot. Probably 20-25% of kids do. And what it means is you have to leave your job. You pick up your kid at school, drive them to the clinic, give them the shot, drive them back to school. They lose an hour of school, disrupting their school day. You lose an hour and a half of work. You go back to work. If we had a public health nurse in the schools doing this, you send a note home to kids, maybe 70%, 80% say they'd like their kids to have flu shots. You line them up and you take care of it at a fraction of the cost. But public health, the local regional planning boards are supposed to be focusing heavily on that. And line 23, you have a 24-hour nurse hotline, 24-hour urgent care clinics available throughout the state. Both of those do a lot to prevent more expensive care. 24-hour nurse hotline prevents a lot of clinic visits. 24-hour urgent care clinics prevents a lot of emergency room visits. And a lot of people who are uninsured use emergency room for things. I've heard of people diaper rash. I've heard of other things like that. Totally inappropriate strep throat or a sore throat that might be strep throat. You don't use emergency rooms for that. If you need an urgent care clinic, it's a lot cheaper way to provide care. Section 6 creates an Office of Health Quality and Planning. I'm not going to go into that more detail now, but the whole point of it is to have a system that works. Section 7 creates an Ombudsman Office for Patient Advocacy. This is the only person who's appointed by the governor in the whole system because the importance is that Ombudsman's supposed to represent the patients with any problems with the health plan or their providers. And so that is totally outside of the plan, but they have access to all the records, all the files. They are responsible for responding to complaints, not just receiving them. There's a grievance system created under Section 8. The Inspector General for the Minnesota Health Plan it would be under the Attorney General's office. They'd be the one who investigates, audits the entire thing. Again, this is 1/6 of the entire state economy. There would be a lot less opportunity for fraud and abuse under a system like this. Just one example is sometimes doctors have, the ones who are doing illegal stuff will bill for multiple patients, more patients than they saw in a day, to different health plans, and nobody knows how many they saw. We saw this with a personal care attendant report the auditor did recently where some people were billing more than 24 hours a day of services. It's kind of hard to work more than 24 hours a day. This would have less fraud in a simple system. The simpler the system, the less fraud, and we would have the auditor to do that. Then the legislative auditor also has access to it. There would be an appropriation from the general fund to provide startup funding for the provisions of the Act, and then the effective date. Before I call on any witnesses, I want to just spell out what this plan does for various people, various types of people. For providers, nursing homes, hospitals, they wouldn't be fighting to get a fair compensation. They wouldn't be struggling to keep their doors open. They wouldn't be dealing with uncompensated care. They'd have much simpler billing procedures. They wouldn't have to have nurses recording every little documentation there. Doctors wouldn't spend much time getting to know new patients who switched health plans because of a switch of jobs, resetting their medications and so on. For school districts, local government, again, this is the biggest cost driver in local governments and schools. Again, with county budgets, the out-of-home placement for kids is breaking the counties. Our correctional costs. If we took just chemical dependency and mental health care and got it to people up front, you would slash those costs. Crime rate would drop. I mean, that is related to this. It's health care, lack of health care, lack of chemical dependency treatment costs a lot of people in a lot of ways, including 200 DWI fatalities a year. For employers, you'd have healthier, more productive work employees. You wouldn't need three or four people to shop for and negotiate a health care plan every year and then explain it to employees. You wouldn't need to figure out how you're going to pay for skyrocketing premiums every year. For farmers, self-employed people, for entrepreneurs, they can devote their energies to their work. They wouldn't have to, farmer has to get a spouse to get a job in town with a business that has some health care benefits because they don't have any other access to them. For people and families, you'd get the care you need when you need it. If you're sick, you go to the doctor. If you need dental care, you go to the dentist. If you need a prescription, you pick it up at the pharmacy, period. You don't have to question whether it's covered or not. You don't have to worry about losing your health care because you graduated from college, or your kid graduated from college. You don't have to worry about it because you lost your job. You don't have to worry about bankruptcy. It's a plan that works for Minnesotans. We believe it would be about 20% cheaper, and I can go into that later as well. But that's the explanation of the bill, and I'd like to be happy to take questions now, but perhaps we should go through witnesses first.
Senator Marty, you're doing really well with the time. That's about, you may even be about 5 minutes ahead of where I thought you would be explaining the bill. Do members have any questions right now? I'm kind of developing some here. I'm making note, but I'll wait till we hear from people. Well, we're going to have people testify, and the questions really would be from the committee members, ma'am. So, but if you have a question that you wanted to come up to the table and ask us, that's fine. But can you not hear me? I'm sorry. I was asking the committee if they wanted to ask questions. And if anybody in the audience has a question or comment they wish to make, there'll be an opportunity to do that. But Senator Marty has some people scheduled to testify. There are some people who want to speak in opposition to this legislation, and we'll start now. Senator Marty, do you want to have them come forward?
Yes, I'd like to call Lisa Sherman.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our committee. And then if you just identify yourself when you start to speak, because it's being taped.
Okay. Hello, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Lisa Sherman, and I live in Stillwater. I'm here today with Take Action Minnesota in support of the Minnesota Health Plan. My son Ian's lung collapsed after getting vaccinated when he was a baby, and he had to be hospitalized. They did a lot of tests but couldn't find a cause. By the time Ian was 18 months old, I knew something was wrong. He was losing his ability to communicate, and he was withdrawn. A year later, he was diagnosed with autism. Now Ian is 11. He is homeschooled, but I can't provide the physical, occupational, and speech therapy he needs to remain functional. We go to OT, occupational therapy, twice a month, and work on activities that help with daily living skills so that Ian is not overwhelmed by his perceptual difficulties. He tends to hold all his tension in his neck, and the physical therapy is teaching him how to relax so he's not in so much pain. Because of speech, Ian has language. Each program gives me activities and exercises to work on with my son so that we can continue to progress. When my husband's company was bought out by a national company, we were elated that he didn't lose his job, but it didn't take long to discover that this new company's health insurance coverage, United Healthcare, was going to be very different. I called to make sure that all my therapies were covered and in network. However, we did not receive the paperwork for the new health insurance company until 3 months later. At this time, I discovered that insurance wouldn't cover speech therapy unless it was for a new injury. The denial left us with a $3,600 bill. I was advised not to fight this because I could be hit with an additional bill for the occupational therapy. Please note that in speech, we were working on getting Ian to speak from the diaphragm instead of from the chest and to make his breathing less shallow. Now we aren't because I don't know what to do. After receiving large numbers of complaints from other employees, my husband's company switched to Blue Cross. In January this year, I paid a bill for the occupational therapy Ian received in June 2008 that wasn't covered. However, they did pay for the other months. This is like Russian roulette. I don't know when I'm covered and when I'm not. You have to be careful with autism. Insurance companies don't understand or want to pay for it. I need to get a doctor's order for everything. It costs me copays just to go to the doctor's order so that I can get these therapies. The system doesn't work. And this is why we need a universal, comprehensive system of health coverage like the Minnesota Health Plan.
Sherman, thank you very much.
I'd like to call on Dr. Ann Setgast.
Good afternoon and welcome to our committee.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Ann Setgast, and as Senator Marty said, I am an internal medicine physician. I work here in St. Paul as a primary care doctor. I'm also here representing today the Minnesota chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. This national organization is dedicated to single-payer health care reform. Our chapter in Minnesota is also a member of the Minnesota Universal Health Care Coalition. I appreciate the ability to be here today, and it's an honor to speak to you. In the few minutes that I have, I'd like to share with you why, as a physician, I'm committed to healthcare reform in the form of a single-payer system or a single plan as embodied in the Minnesota Health Plan. I think nearly everyone in the room would agree that the system is fundamentally flawed, but as a doctor, I deal firsthand and I get a firsthand view of why the system is, how broken it truly is. I'd like to start with the basics. As a physician, but also as a citizen, I firmly believe health care is a right. I believe it is a right of all people and should be provided equitably. I believe it is a common good, and I don't feel that it should be bought and sold as a commodity. To me, the reasons for this are obvious. In a direct sense, we know that health care alleviates human suffering. But we also know that having health care allows each of us to flourish as individuals in other aspects of our life. And this is really what led me to become a doctor, was I felt that it was one of the most fundamental ways in which I could help people. We hear a lot about personal responsibility and lifestyle choices that people make. And while I know, as a primary care physician, I very much value the healthy lifestyle choices my patients make. But in working with them daily, I also know that if you are a non-smoker, you exercise regularly, you eat all the right things, you're still not guaranteed to be free from illness. In fact, the biggest risk factor that everyone in this room has for getting sick is the fact that we're human. And this is why I really think that healthcare, because we all are in the same boat, should be provided equitably and the access should be equal. Working daily with a mostly insured, so not uninsured, but an insured patient population, has convinced me that having health insurance coverage or using the health insurance industry to solve our problem is not going to fix it. This is why I'm wary of proposals that simply attempt to expand coverage. The reason for this is we all probably know of horror stories, as we just heard one, of patients who have coverage, but it doesn't actually cover the care that they need. One of the most recent examples I can think of is I also work on the inpatient side in the hospital several weeks per year, and one of the hospital patients I took care of recently was a middle-aged woman who was in with an asthma exacerbation. So that's what I was actually treating her for, but her primary care doctor had diagnosed an ovarian mass several months earlier because she had pelvic pain. She knew that she needed to have the mass explored and removed and had scheduled the surgery twice. However, she told me that she had canceled it each time because she hadn't been able to get a clear answer from her company whether or not it was insured, and she obviously had insurance. And she was just scared to have the surgery and then get a bill that she knew she wouldn't pay or wouldn't be able to pay. From a different perspective, as Senator Marty mentioned, the number one cause, as we know, of personal bankruptcy in the U.S. is medical bills. But I think what's really important to remember about this fact that is of the people who go bankrupt because of medical bills, the majority of these people had insurance. I think this fact alone speaks very, very loudly to the fact or to the reason why we cannot rely on private insurance to solve our problems. I think because of the business model that private insurance must adopt to remain viable, the industry is faced with incentives that cause them to avoid the sick, or at least to not care for the sick when they become ill. And as someone whose sole responsibility it is to care for the sick, I find this unconscionable. When I meet patients, if you were my patient, I would be interested in what you came to see me for. I would be interested in your symptoms and how I could diagnose and treat you to make you better. I wouldn't be interested in who your insurance carrier is. However, I have to find that out because some of my medical decisions are dependent on who your insurer is. And I truly resent this. I resent this interference in the patient-doctor relationship. I was trained in medical school to be accountable to my patients, not to their insurer. My other concern with reform that is based on the private insurance model is the lack of cost containment. The evidence supporting the cost savings inherent in single-payer systems is ample. The savings come mainly, but not solely, through cutting excessive administrative waste. We know this waste exists on both the side of insurers and on the side of the providers, my clinic, for example. As it is now, with more than 1,000 insurers in the United States, our healthcare dollars are spent on activities that have nothing to do with health. We spend 31 cents of each dollar administering our patchwork system. 31 cents of each dollar. On the insurer side, some of this spending goes to overhead that, as I mentioned, has nothing to do with health. It is spent on marketing and sales. It is spent on underwriting. In some cases, there are excessive administrator salaries. And in states other than Minnesota, there's profit. On the provider side, The bureaucracy that is required to collect payment from hundreds of insurers is chaotic and complex. Each of them have their own sets of rules. And as an example, if you look at a 500-bed hospital in Canada, the billing department would employ about 10 persons, but that same hospital, same size, same function on the other side of the border, would employ about 50. I think there is some fear surrounding single-payer reform, and I would like to address that. I think from a patient perspective, it is important to remember that if you're a patient and a system would change to single-payer, what would change would be the card that you carry in your wallet, if you carry an insurance card, that is. You'll still visit the doctor when you need to, and you'll still get the care that you need. In fact, things will look pretty much the same, except for the billing department in the clinic that you attend. That is because under single-payer systems, the funding is public, but the delivery is still private. I think it's important from a physician perspective that you know what physicians think of single-payer systems. And there are two pertinent surveys that I want to draw your attention to. One was published here in Minnesota in February of 2007 in a journal called Minnesota Medicine. Physicians in the state of Minnesota were randomly sampled, and several hundred of them responded with a question regarding their preference for the type of healthcare financing that was available. They were given three options. One was single-payer, one was health savings accounts, and one was managed care. 64% of Minnesota physicians surveyed voted in favor of a single-payer system. On the national level, a similar study was actually just published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in April of 2008. And physicians were asked, and I'll give you the quote. The survey asked, in principle, do you support or oppose government legislation to establish national health insurance, end quote. 59% of the thousands of doctors surveyed in the United States answered this question favorably. But what I think is more interesting is that the same survey was done 5 years ago, and the data was collected in 2002, and the favorable response rate at that time was 49%. What this suggests to me is that our current system, the failure of our current system, is a pressing issue for physicians. Remember, what is of interest to most doctors is not underwriting, marketing, or excessive profits, but rather how to provide high-quality care to our patients. On a local note, and this is my final thought, I'd like to share that I'm not a native Minnesotan, but what keeps me here is the climate, and I don't mean the weather, because I actually don't like winter. But I actually think Minnesota is a fantastic place to practice medicine. I did my residency training here, and I've stayed. And there are several things that makes Minnesota really great from a healthcare perspective. It's home to groundbreaking research. Minnesota has above-average health statistics. And we have a relatively low level of uninsured. We're fourth in the country in terms of our uninsurance rate, although it's still too high. I think there is substantial momentum for reform here, and I think the populace is driven and devoted toward change. And I think that given Minnesota's history of political innovation and its reputation as a leader in healthcare, I think it's a fantastic spot to also lead the nation in healthcare reform. And therefore, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled to be part of this movement, and I encourage your support for the Minnesota Health Plan.
Thank you very much.
My last witness is Nancy Braymeyer.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Nancy Braymeyer, and I'm here representing Metro Independent Business Alliance. I personally reside in Senate District of the Honorable James Medson, District 39.
Are we on TV?
Emphasis on honorable.
The honorable, thank you.
And President of the Senate, yes.
Put me up here. That's
at least I got a nice red face out of you on that one. I'm also an independent financial advisor and co-owner of Amore Coffee in Senate District 64. Metro IBA has approximately 100 members. And it also has some citizen members, and we're still growing. Metro IBA has members in each of your Senate districts, except for Austin and Albert Lea. Our focus is the metro area, and we are part of a greater umbrella organization called the American Alliance. And it has IBAs all across the country. As president, I am certain that even though our focus is the metro area, our needs are similar to those around the state. I'm very happy to be in front of this committee, a committee that understands numbers and how it affects commerce in the state of Minnesota. According to a 2007 study done by the U.S. Small Business Administration, Minnesota has over 500,000 small businesses. 200,000 of those employ less than 100 employees. According to that study, businesses that employ less than 50, the job gains are 26.2%. Contrary, businesses employing 500 or more saw a negative growth of employment of 13.4%. According to an Andersonville study and others, 68 cents of every dollar stays in the community with a locally owned independent business, compared to 32 cents with regional national chains. Clearly, small business is the backbone of our state's economy, and keeping small business healthy keeps Minnesota healthy. When I was asked 3 years ago to support this initiative, I was unsure of its ability. I understood health insurance very well because I sold it in my planning practice. I researched this idea, and last year was part of a purchasing pool work group. This work group had many stakeholders, including Senator Olson, Senator Erickson Robes, Senator Neuville, Representative Schumpeter, Murphy, and Broad. There were also two docs and a nurse, representatives from education, labor, large businesses, and the Attorney General's office. I consider myself well-versed on health care. As small businesses, our biggest hurdle is leveling the playing field. We struggle buying products in large quantities. This is true when it comes to office supplies, products on our shelves, and more importantly, health care. We do not have the numbers to spread the risk, so our health care premiums are much higher. Typically, our workers are part to full-time, thus making it even harder to spread the risk to cover all of our employees. Locally, one of our larger businesses in the organization that did cover all of its people with insurance had one claim, and that claim doubled their premiums. They went to shop for health insurance to see if they could lower that, and no other insurance company would take them. So they were forced to have to spread that cost down to their employees, and their employees were not prepared to do that. High premiums inhibit small independent businesses from hiring more people, particularly if they pay a portion of that premium. Also, if the premiums are high, the employees can't afford to pay them. For example, a large chain coffee company, which I won't say which one, large enough to spread its risk, therefore it can have lower health premiums. So a 50-year-old female employee may have a cost of $150 a month. That same premium at my coffee shop is $295. $7.50 an hour, that means that worker has to work 15 more hours a month. Where would you go to work? Healthcare insurance works well when you have a very large group to insure. It also works well when you can cherry-pick the healthiest of people. This has been standard operating procedures in our insurance industry. Insurance companies and large businesses have large groups, and they have cherry-picked the healthiest of people, leaving behind smaller groups and those who can't afford or can't get insurance. But as an independent business owner, we naturally look for solutions outside the box. We are innovative by nature and follow the dollars back and forth to find a solution. First, let's put all the facts on the table. Whether you have insurance or not, people get sick. We all pay for that care, whether directly or indirectly. Talking to collection agencies, the most effective way to get money is either collect it up front or bill it and have it paid within 30 days. This is how health insurance got started. Years ago, hospitals found that if people paid a little every month, when they got sick, they had enough to pay for the problem. Not everyone got sick at the same time, not everyone had the same problem, and some didn't get sick at all. This is the basis of pooling. These pools made a lot of sense and, frankly, were making money. The Minnesota Health Plan is a free market concept. Clinics are free to give care to their patients, not managing the bills or deciphering the paperwork. Business freeing up their time to do their business instead of deciding which plan is the most beneficial to their employees and which one's more cost-effective for their own business. Workers are free from worry if their insurance will cover a sickness. Workers are free to pick and see a doctor of their choice, and workers are free to work where they want to work, or perhaps start a business that they have always wanted to start. Let's think of how much money we would be saved if we could all figure out just think of how much money will be saved if we don't have to figure out who to exclude, what procedure to exclude, and what clinic or hospital to exclude. Minnesota Health Plan is fair to every Minnesotan, efficient for every Minnesotan, and cost-effective for every Minnesotan. This is Main Street economics. Metro IBA is 100% behind the Minnesota Health Plan. We think it only makes sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Marty?
I'm done with my witnesses. If you have a list of those you want to call on, then.
Okay, then I have Julie Brunner. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Brunner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We're the trade association for the 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. Our members provide coverage to more than 4 million people. I'm going to start by thanking Senator Marty again for the time he's taken to sit down with us, go through the bill, help us understand the bill. And I would say that there are many of the goals in Senator Marty's bill that we all can share. We all know there are problems with the healthcare system. My members share the frustration over rising health care costs and therefore rising premiums, making coverage more affordable for people. You frequently hear complaints about measures health plans try to take to keep costs down. Health care leaders across the world are struggling to balance the needs of citizens with the economic realities of health care's rising costs. Recently, an expat on globalpost.com, we're getting into the 21st century here, wrote about health care for herself, a middle-class person in France. She wrote, "I pay more for my health care in France than I did in the U.S. I'm paying almost 50% of every doctor's visit. This is even while she was pregnant. Much of my laboratory tests I have paid for about 60% of my sonograms and about 50 to 60% of any of the medications. I pay 50 euros a month for supplemental insurance on top of the 30% of my salary that goes for insurance. The Canadian single-payer system does not cover outpatient prescription drugs. Certain cancer treatments are limited in the United Kingdom's single-payer system. I share these stories with you not to demean these other systems, but to say that there are many other single-payer systems that are operating around the world, and every one of those systems has the issue of cost. They all have problems. And if the proposal that Senator Marty is making could be the euphoric, problem-free system, well, then it would be really hard to resist. But I don't think that that's true in the proposal that he's making. I share the stories with you because cost is the number one issue, no matter what system provides your health care coverage. And coverage for all cannot possibly be sustained without efforts to deal with those costs. Unfortunately, Senate File 118 doesn't truly address the cost issue. It's too easy to claim eliminating health plans solves the cost problem. The work of the health plans must still be done. Accountability has to remain in any health system that we have. Health care is not expensive because of insurance. Insurance is expensive because of health care costs. We agree that reform is needed in this country. Universal coverage should be all of our goal. However, a government-run system in Minnesota is not the answer. This legislature passed broad reforms just last session. you mandated significant changes in to get at the issue of the cost of health care. And your 2008 legislation hasn't even been fully implemented yet. Senate File 118 throws out the entire system, the good and the bad. This is neither the quickest nor the most efficient way to cover all Minnesotans. We're committed to making sustainable universal coverage a reality and will continue to work with the with legislative leadership to make it happen. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Ms. Brunner, if I might just ask a question, do you think that the issue is that the fact that these other plans are single payer and therefore we shouldn't adopt that system, or you know, you're talking about France and Canada and Britain?
Madam Chair, really my point is that we're really talking about a market-based system or going to a single government-run system. My point in bringing up what's going on in other countries, and I've done a little bit of reading about this, especially as we've been talking to Senator Marty, is that there are problems in every country that is trying to, that has a government-run health care system. I mean, in France, my understanding is 90-plus percent of the French carry a supplemental system because the state-operated framework, the basic insurance, does not cover all the insurance or the medical services that people want. So there are many variations all around the globe, if you will, and there isn't a complete single-payer system, I think, of the type described in this bill. I mean, every country is dealing with costs.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Bremer. I'd just like to respond a little bit, and I have lots of comments I'd like to respond to, but first thing I'd like to do is just thank Senator Marty for the work that he's done on this bill, and thank all the people who are here in this room for their interest and caring enough to come here today. I've had a lot of community, as we all have, gone out and had community meetings around my district. And the overwhelming concern I continue to hear from people, even with these, you know, the economy being so much of a concern, is the cost of health care. Because, you know, that's with people losing their jobs, that makes their lack of health insurance that much more concerning. And the more pressures we have on our economy, the more of an issue this becomes. When I talk about the Minnesota Health Plan to people, the question I get is, well, why aren't you getting that done? And what I tell them is because this isn't going to be an easy thing, because there are a lot of stakeholder interests, there's a lot of politics involved, there's just frankly a lot of money involved. And any kind of a large change that involves a lot of money is not an easy thing. So if we're going to get this done, it's going to have to come from the grassroots. There's going to have to be enough pressure among people and on politicians and on our political system for us to really get the message that this is something that people want. But to get – Senator Erickson Ropes and I actually went up to Canada this last fall on a fact-finding mission. We were both involved, as many of us in the Senate have been, of working groups within the Healthcare Access Commission, and we also had the pooling working group that Ms. Braemeyer referred to. So we learned a lot about these different systems that Ms. Bremer is referring to. And I have to say that, yes, it is very true that there's no such thing as a perfect healthcare system anywhere in the world. However, some work a lot better than others. Some provide much more universal care than others. Some are much less expensive than others. And so to try to find out firsthand what people thought about their healthcare system, Senator Erickson Ropes and I went up to Canada. We went to Thunder Bay, and then we went over to Winnipeg. And without going into all the different stories we heard from people there, you know, we certainly heard an overwhelming message from that no one there would trade their system for ours. And they were frankly thought it was immoral that people were going through bankruptcy or not having access to health, you know, simply because of health care needs. That was very hard for them to understand. It was also very hard for them to understand that we would have a third party coming between what a doctor would recommend for that person and the patient making those kinds of decisions. And the doctors in that system told us they would never tolerate something like that. One story to me really hit home, and that was from a woman who likes to vacation in Florida during part of the year. She was a receptionist at a large hospital in Thunder Bay. And she said, you know, before I go down to Florida, I buy a policy from your system that's supposed to cover me while I'm there in case anything happens, because I know your system is so much more expensive and Canada will only reimburse any health care needs at the level, the rate they would have paid. So I bought a policy, and while I was in Florida, I had pneumonia, and I had to be hospitalized for a week. And I was told by the health insurance company that because I had had lung cancer many years ago, that was a pre-existing condition because it was in my lungs. And so I came home back to Canada not only with having paid over $1,000 for this insurance policy that was supposed to cover me, but I had a bill for over $20,000 for the health care, the hospitalization that I'd had while I was down in Florida. And she said, I don't think, you know, I'll be able to make too many trips back to the United States if that's the kind of thing that could be happening to me in the future. So I guess my point is that we can find individual problems or unique issues that different countries have faced, but they have a means to deal with them and correct them in a much more straightforward way than we do. And it's really a misnomer when you characterize this as a government-run healthcare system, because the doctors in Canada feel they have much more freedom to practice medicine because the government isn't running their healthcare. In this country, the insurance industry is running our healthcare system. And to me, that's where health insurance crossed the line and went from something that would be favorable in terms of something that would help people through pooling, and went to something where we're treating healthcare like a commodity, when they got to start having the say of how people are going to receive their healthcare under the auspices of managed care. Because I've worked in that system, and that's part of the reason I'm sitting here today in the Senate. As an attorney, I used to represent people who needed health care. And I can tell you that there are many situations where between two different auto insurance carriers, a workers' comp carrier, and some government health care programs, a whole lot more money was spent fighting over who was going to pay these bills than if the bill had simply just been paid in the first place. So, I mean, I could go on all day. I'll stop there.
Actually, Senator Olson, no, you can't.
Okay.
No, Thank you, Senator. You're fine, Senator Olson.
Okay.
Senator Prettner-Solon, did you?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bruner, I understand your comments about the problems they have in other communities, other nations, and in single-payer systems, but the one thing that we can't seem to accommodate in a market-based economy or a market-based healthcare system is universal coverage or coverage for everybody. And that, for me, is the selling point in a system that is similar to this. And I'm wondering if you can respond to that.
Ms. Bruner.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, I absolutely agree with you and with people in the room that everyone should have access to health care. I mean, it's an embarrassment in a country with the kinds of riches that we have that everyone isn't covered. And I think there are ways to do it. I think some of it goes to the way we set our priorities in spending. I think that there are different models that we could look at that would expand coverage to individuals who do work but can't afford to pay their premiums. I mean, there are models out there that I think if we made this a priority, we could get there. And I also agree that it seems very attractive to go to something that looks like it would cover everyone, especially in the economic calamity that we're in right now. I mean, it's frightening for people. I mean, I have family who are concerned about it. We all know someone. So I do understand the sort of imperative that people are feeling around this issue. But I don't know that the proposal in this bill has anything built in to contain costs. I mean, what is going to keep costs from rising? What's going to keep hospital, clinic, any therapy costs from rising? I mean, that's what's driving the cost of health care. And we need to have some way to control that or level it off. So I believe there are other models. I think there are subsidies. I think this legislature has taken huge steps forward in Minnesota Care and in some of the things that you've done in the expansion of Medicaid to cover low-income individuals. So we could get there if it was a priority, I believe, anyway.
You know, Senator Marty, you said earlier, and I say it all the time, we really have universal health coverage in Minnesota, because if you're sick and if you present yourself at the emergency room, you get care. But it sure isn't very smart money.
No.
And we are all in this room paying that. And I think that's what we're trying, you know, to get to the bottom of. But, Ms. Bruner, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I know that, is Mike Burris here? Or good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Mike Burris. I work with an outfit called AdvisorNet Financial. For the last 30 years, I've been an employee benefits broker and consultant. I live in Senator Saltzman's district, Lake Elmo. I work downtown Minneapolis for an office, but I'm actually around the state a lot, working with small employers, primarily helping them solve their health insurance and other employee benefit issues. I'm here today representing Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. That's about 450 of the state's most professional and dedicated insurance brokers, some carrier representatives, and third-party administrators. In Minnesota, as in America, you know, those who strive for something better, be that a good education, a good job, a nice automobile, a home, a reasonable retirement, all of that is achievable with hard work, perseverance, and fortitude. You know, the same is really true in health care. If I want to and am willing to make it a priority in my life, I can have a decent amount of health care above and beyond what government provides. You know, from Medicare to Medicaid to medical assistance to Minnesota Care to Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association to free community clinics and programs that I probably don't even know about, government has something for everyone who doesn't or can't find an answer. But, you know, if government were to say, now, we have too many homeless people in Minnesota, or we have too many people underhoused, whatever that might mean. So government's going to provide housing for all citizens. By the way, you have no choice. You will live in government housing. And regardless of how hard you've worked or the value you've contributed to society, government's going to decide how many square feet you get, whether you have a yard or you don't, how much you pay for it based on your income, what amenities the house might have, and it'll be based on this year's budget, which we may or may not be able to fund. Okay. And I think if we went to that, I don't think anybody would be really very happy. In Minnesota, in spite of our high cost, our citizens do have access to the best health care in the world. Many people from around the world come to this state for their health care. I listen to complaints all day long, frankly, from employers and employees about the cost of health care. But the fact is they then have the opportunity to explore alternatives and to make choices with some very innovative insurance products to reduce their cost and do a good job for their people. If we go to this kind of a plan, we're taking those freedoms away. I came here to represent the Association of Health Underwriters. Let me tell you, there's some brilliant people in that organization that have been working hard lately in uncompensated time to come up with a platform that would be helpful to all of you as we all struggle for the same thing. I don't think we're really opposed to each other on many points here. We all want the same kinds of things. We're going to be bringing to each of the senators and representatives in each of our districts those points in the next few weeks. But the idea that the theory that government takeover can really lower cost or improve efficiencies is really an unproven one. And so we ask that you thoughtfully consider voting against this bill.
Okay. Mr. Burris, I'm not sure if I don't think you meant to do that, but did you kind of imply that if you work really hard and earn more money, that you should have access to a better health plan or better, therefore better health care?
As with cars and housings and everything else, absolutely.
Okay. I guess you did mean to say that.
Really, I surely did. This is America, not a socialist state yet.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and sir, with all due respect, and I'm not even going to touch on, you know, what I think has to be a value judgment, I'm just going to respond to what you said about innovative insurance products. Because I chaired the committee that was supposed to look at how we could find reform within our existing system. And I never saw a single proposal within that came from the industry that didn't simply just involve shifting costs, but it protected the insurance industry's position at all costs. When you offer a high deductible HSA, you're not saving any costs in the system. You're simply having individuals pay more costs. And I can tell you that our hospital administrator in Bemidji just talked about the fact that HSAs have greatly increased the uncompensated care rate because people buy those policies simply because that's all they can afford in most cases. Then they can't go to the doctor because they never get to the point where someone else, they can't afford to pay for the care themselves either. The shopping online thing that we put in place last year, I think many of us didn't agree with. We went along with that because there were some other aspects of the reform bill that we maybe favored. But when I talk to people on the ground and patients, the idea that they're going to go and cost shop for a doctor is so out of touch with how we actually access health care, especially in rural communities where we're lucky if we can even get in to see a doctor. It's really just disingenuous to act like there's this free market system out there and that people can utilize it as if they were going to buy a car. It just doesn't work that way.
So I don't know that there was a question, but Mr. Burris, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Beth McMullen. And Stacia Smith, welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Beth McMullen, and I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. The partnership represents 110 large employers in Minnesota. Our members are manufacturers, service providers, retailers, etc., in Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of our whole membership. As employers who provide self-funded health benefits for hundreds of thousands of employees and their families, I appreciate the opportunity to comment on Senator Marty's bill. The business partnership opposes a single-payer approach such as this for Minnesota. Our members support reforms that will achieve a market-based, patient-centered healthcare system. I very much appreciate the focus in Senator Marty's bill on prevention and early intervention, which is something we certainly hope to achieve in any healthcare reform effort. And we also agree with the premise of ensuring everyone receives high-quality care. We have a 10-point vision on healthcare that asks for a universal coverage for everyone in healthcare. That does not mean single payer. It is just one of a 10-point plan that also addresses market, choice, personal responsibility, quality and cost information, competition, and increased efficiencies in our system. We believe, Senator Prettner-Solon, to your point, we believe that the key to access is affordability. Affordability for the individual, for the employer who might be providing health benefits, or for the government safety net programs. And affordability lies in restraining the rapidly growing cost of care. There are certainly problems in our healthcare system, and we all know those very well. And I agree that I think we all understand those issues. We're trying to address these issues through reforms such as we passed last session, and we were happy, the business partnership was happy to support that health care reform bill. They address things such as payment reform, care coordination, price and quality transparency for the consumer, investment in public health, and administrative simplicity. However, we do not believe that you can simply compare our current problematic system to the idea that a government-funded and run program would inherently rid the system of problems. Professor Michael Porter of the Harvard Business School said, quote, "It simply strains credulity to imagine that a large government entity would streamline administration, simplify prices, set prices according to true costs, help patients make choices based on excellence and value, establish value-based competition at the provider level, and make the politically neutral and tough choices to deny patients and possibly reimbursement to substandard providers." Professor Porter also notes in his book, Redefining Healthcare, that the escalating costs of care in virtually all advanced economies, including those with single-payer systems, are causing them to consider how care is delivered and paid for. I've given you a printout, which should be in your packet, which is a web page from the PBS program Frontline. Last year, in April, I believe it was April 2008, they did a program on healthcare systems around the world compared to the U.S. You can see on that sheet that I gave you that each of them are struggling with their own problems, some of them very similar to ours. And yes, some of them have successes where our system has failed. And again, I agree that our system has failures. I encourage you to take a look at this program. You can find it by just Googling Sick Around the World and Frontline, and you should be able to find it. When you watch that program, I want you to listen to not just the positives of those different systems, but also to the problems of the escalating costs. It shows that it provides a good overview of some similar capitalist democracies that are all experiencing the same cost growth problems that we do here in the U.S. Let me leave you with a few concerns about this bill specifically. First, I believe that it may be asking for ERISA preemption, or a waiver from the ERISA preemption. It's unclear, but we would certainly oppose this. I won't go into depth about ERISA, but it essentially provides multi-state employers to the ability to provide benefits to their employees, regardless of what state they live in, without regulation state by state, which makes it very difficult for an employer to provide these benefits. Second, I'm not an attorney, but I understand that there are some definite concerns about subrogation within this bill. It's questionable about whether if an employee would drop an employer-provided health benefit program to move to the Minnesota Health Plan, if that employee becomes sick, if the Minnesota Health Plan would be able to go back and collect funds from the employer that previously covered this employee. Third, it appears that there is a prohibition on private coverage. Employers use employee health benefits as a way to recruit employees, and for my members, this is from across state lines. So this could provide a recruitment problem for multi-state employers. Fourth, there are some serious concerns with Minnesota implementing this alone as a state entity without a federal lead. It does refer to asking for state or federal waivers for it to do this, but it's unclear to me how much leeway would have to be given to this state, and there's a number of federal hoops that they would need to jump through in order to achieve this. There is no other state in the U.S. who has gone through this process, so Minnesota would be leading that unknown, that charge into the unknown. I just want to point out a couple of issues in the bill as well. Page 7, line 8, it talks about, it says when there are sufficient funds to cover the expansion. But elsewhere in the bill, it says that premiums and taxes will only be high enough to pay for what is deemed medically necessary. That actually leads to my second point, page 7, line 11. The medical benefit will be determined by the board. The board is chosen by a regional health planning board. None of these are elected and therefore are not accountable to the taxpayer and patients. There also talk about an ombudsman and an inspector general. So there's a lot of new entities that would be in place to that we'd have to figure out how those all work together for the benefit of the individual patients. Page 7, line 23, says that they shall not pay for certain prescriptions if those prescriptions are advertised. My question is, if those are even medically necessary, they're not going to be allowed because a company is expressing their right to advertise. Page 9, line 14, talks about the reserves of any state, county, city, and it's unclear if maybe some of the school districts and other health plans, their funds for health care would have to be transferred to the state, and I think there would be question among some of those entities about that transfer. Page 15 and 19, as I talked before, talks about the Regional Health Planning Board and the Minnesota Health Board. Let me end with my largest concern, which is really the business health tax that would fund this Minnesota health plan. There is no further description of this tax, what it would be based on, what rate it would be, how it would be collected, etc. Therefore, it's difficult for me to address this tax specifically. Senator Marty has said that he assumes that this tax would be lower than current health care costs to businesses, but we have absolutely no idea if this would actually be true because we don't know what the cost of this system would be. And costs vary greatly employer to employer. So what might be a savings for one company is certainly going to be an additional cost for another company. In this economy, and we're all talking about this, we're in a recession, and we recognize how difficult this economy is for everyone. A lot of the legislative leaders are talking about jobs, and jobs specifically, job growth here in Minnesota. Let me suggest that billing job creators in Minnesota through this unidentified tax for the cost of this plan would most certainly drive jobs out of this state. And with that, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
McMullen, I missed the part about the tax, but I thought I heard Senator Marty say that about half of the cost today is borne by employers, and I don't know if businesses have ever quantified the tax that we have today in the way of their property tax for the health care that's provided. You know, just in Hennepin County, where I live, I'm sure I know businesses paying that as well as individuals. Homeowners and renters, we're all paying those costs. We are certainly paying for Medicaid through our taxes, and for uncompensated care. I don't know, Senator Marty, have you ever quantified what isn't officially billed to businesses or individuals? That to me would be really interesting to see that figure, because I don't think you see this costing business more, do you?
Chair, we think the cost of the whole thing, and I can get into costs more later, would be about 20% less. But the bottom line is, we're spending in this country our governmental spending, whether it's state, school board, county, federal government, our governmental health care costs are almost as great as it is in all these other countries of the world. It's only half of our health care system, though, because we're spending twice as much. So, it's a lot of that does get paid for by public programs and so on. But.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Ms. McMullen's concern is about the small businessman that doesn't provide tax currently. And this would require it.
I know that somebody's probably having trouble hearing.
And it would put that type of business maybe out of business to incur that additional cost.
So, Senator Marty, I don't want to respond to that.
The assumption is, most employers would be paying significantly less, but some don't provide any health care benefits whatsoever. They'd be paying more because they're not paying now.
Senator Gerlach. Oh, I'm sorry.
So in average, they'd be paying significantly less, but if you're not providing any benefits right now, or very few. If you a large employer, large retail employer who may have a plan nominally available to people, but they pay very small share of it and very few people take them up on it, they may have very low health care costs because their employees aren't covered. And, of course, the rest of us pick up that when they use the emergency room and so on. But
Ms. McMullen, did you want to
Yes, Madam Chair. I would just like to respond to this because I am here specifically representing large employers who are generally self-insured.
Right.
And these are multi-state employers who have may have employees in 1, 2, or 50 states. Minnesota enacting single payer and taxing them for their employee Minnesota employees will not eliminate the need and the expense to these companies who have employees in other states where they still need to provide health benefits for active recruitment and retention.
Okay, thank you. Senator Gerlach, and then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, Ms. McMullen talked about a prohibition on private coverage. Can you explain what that is and how that fits into your bill?
Sure.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, first of all, yeah, I've never claimed this is going to solve the problems of those employers in the other states. It'll take care of their problems in Minnesota only. But in terms of the lack of prohibition on private coverage, yes, this is meant to be. That's why I'm saying this isn't like any other country. It's not like Canada where people have private insurance. I think what this plan is meant to cover all of your health care. The whole problem we have here, you know, we've got insurance is we seem to be finding new ways to provide insurance for things. It used to be just medical insurance. Now you have dental insurance. You now have prescription drug insurance if you're a senior. You now have long-term care insurance we're trying to buy. The point is this is supposed to be a health care plan that covers everything. We're all in the same plan. Our constituents have the same quality health care that we get. It's to make sure everybody has quality care. And if you, what Canada and some other places have done is they've tried to, and again, they're half what we spend on it, but they're trying to cut corners in such a way they just say, well, we're not going to provide this service or that service, and then you push it off to private insurance. The point here is to provide a comprehensive health care service.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Marty.
Gerlach.
Senator Marty, you had a witness earlier that said that she believes that health care is a right, and I think that you probably share that belief. You're nodding your head, yes. So if you accept the proposition that health care is a right and then you prohibit somebody from pursuing some coverage or health care above and beyond what is this plan, that is circular logic. I mean, you're defending a right, but yet then you're saying that you can't have the health coverage that you want. Can you explain that conflict?
Sure. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, first let me say that I'm not saying there's a right to health insurance. I'm saying there's a right to health care. You can go to the doctor, the hospital, the clinic, the chiropractor, the physical therapist, whatever you need, you go to get the care you need. This does not prohibit insurance for things that the plan does not cover. Like one of them, I mean, if, I don't know that anybody sells cosmetic surgery insurance because I think that's more in the desires of the person than something you could insure for. But you could sell insurance if you wanted for private hospital rooms when they're not medically indicated because the bill does not guarantee it has most hospital rooms are two beds in them. This explicitly says that it only covers single occupancy rooms if it's medically indicated. So, yeah, you could provide care for that, but everything else, it's the only prohibition is on covering things that are already covered. There wouldn't be much reason for it. I don't think there'd be any market for it. Again, Ms. McMullen said on the prescription drug thing, yeah, no prescription drug company is going to advertise Lipitor or something. You know, if nobody in Minnesota can buy it, I mean, if the health plan pays for everybody's drugs and the health plan won't cover it, if you advertise here, they'll just stop advertising it here because their interest is not in advertising, their interest is in selling. So, but the point is, no, it's you get the care you need, period.
Okay. And Senator Gerlach. Madam Chair, this is not something you have to answer to because I'm not sure this is the appropriate time, but it's often brought up the rationing issue, and I don't know what the truth is because we hear stories. We hear stories about, in Canada or Great Britain, about rationing, and then we have Senator Olson who went up to Canada and heard some other stories. Did you catch some fish while you were up there?
I didn't have time.
Didn't have time to go fishing. But you had conducted some interviews with some folks and such. But I think it would just be helpful for us if somebody, who, any other witnesses, or if you can, or any, at any point in time, not the rhetoric, but the truth on rationing. And because I don't want to go down that road. I don't think people do. I don't want somebody in some government board deciding what health care. And I think you're going to probably say that you're not going down that path, but I don't know.
Okay, Madam Chair, this is a critically important question, and I will take the frontline things she handed out and encourage you to watch that, because it's only an hour-long show, and it's pretty powerful, and I think it shows pretty much about a good reality. None of those systems are perfect. Matter of fact, I think we try and learn from some of the mistakes some of those countries have. But rationing, I don't like healthcare rationing by either government. I don't think that's appropriate. I don't like rationing by insurance company. I don't think that's appropriate. I think decisions about healthcare should be made by the patient and their doctor. And people, lest people think, oh, yeah, people want to get all kinds of healthcare anytime they can if it's, they call it free. It's not free by any means. It's very expensive. But people should be making their decisions between them and their doctor. Back surgery, I've had some, but I think if patients and their doctors are talking about it and what the options are, very few people want the more intrusive act if the other one may have better results. End-of-life care. If doctors and patients are talking about end-of-life care, most people, when they have a choice, if they're in pain and their heart stops, they don't want to be resuscitated. Yet our healthcare system assumes they have to. If we should be self-rationing. We determine what care we want, not government, and this bill actually prohibits it. That's the principles at the top. When I had the bill on those principles in front of state and local a couple of years ago, Senator Roebling picked out the one saying this plan is not allowed to deny care in order to save money. You cannot do that, because I don't think we should determine, oh, somebody doesn't qualify, they're too old, or they're too something else. I think decisions on health care should be made by the person and their doctor.
Senator Olson, and then we'll get to you, Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just also like to address this for a minute, because I think there's a real confusion about the difference between rationing and capacity of the system. We have some issues in rural health care right now, where we have people who are having to wait, I'm told by their doctor, 3 months or more sometimes just to get in for a primary care physical, because we don't have the access to primary care physicians that we should have. And honestly, there's nothing we can do very easily within our system to address that problem. In Canada, they have had in the past some access issues, and we've heard about them. And they've taken specific steps to make sure that they've increased capacity of physicians so that if there are enough physicians available, if there are enough MRI machines available, then there won't be a backlog of people waiting to deal with or to have that kind of access. And they've been able to do that very directly because of the kind of system they have. So no one has ever said you can't have that. As I said, in Canada, the doctor and patient make those decisions. And how quickly you get access to non-emergency kinds of things is more of a capacity issue. And, of course, they're putting far fewer resources into this. Their capacity issues are improving. Our capacity issues are worsening, even though we're spending much more. But we do have direct rationing within our system, and that's what happens with managed care. And I think that's what really concerns me today, is that we're starting to accept as a society the idea that we can make these judgments about who's going to get care and who's going to not get care based on real rationing kinds of philosophies.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name, for the record, is Stacia Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber is the state's largest business advocacy organization in the state. We represent over 2,700 members, 80% of which have 100 employees or fewer, meaning they're small businesses. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on Senator Marty's bill today, and I just want to keep it brief and echo the concerns that Ms. McMullen just laid out. The Minnesota Chamber opposes a government-run single-payer approach to healthcare financing. We oppose the undefined business tax to pay for any such system. However, I do want to emphasize that the business community is committed to discussions around market-based reform and competition. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And then, pardon me, Mr. Schwartz. John Schwartz here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Schwartz. I'm a single-payer advocate, although opposed to this particular bill.
You're just really going to confuse them.
Yes.
Okay.
We're clarifying. I've been involved with a lot of the main single-payer groups here in the metro area and created my own organization. And I was a member of the single-payer working group of the legislature in 2007. The one very concrete reason that I oppose this bill is in point one, I refer to absolute opposition, by which I mean a showstopper that I think anyone should oppose this bill, even the most ardent single-payer advocate. And the reason is, as I put in quotes there,
and I think we have, excuse me, Mr. Schwartz.
Yes.
I think we have in our packet some of your testimony.
Yes.
So that's what you would like us to be
yes.
looking at while you're speaking
yes,
to us.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
The bill implementing a single-payer system in Minnesota rests on getting these agreements from the federal government for Minnesota to do certain things to enact a single-payer bill. And then here in 1024B and 1025, it says if we can't get that federal approval, the board shall adopt rules, seek conforming state legislation consistent with federal law in an effort to best fulfill the purposes of this chapter. That's what I object to. That essentially is saying if we can't get these things to enact a single-payer system, the board or the state is authorized to adopt other reform types. But they're not specified. And there are a whole host of ways in which you could try to meet these principles in the bill that might be very much not palatable. Some might be, some might not be. I object to sort of writing this blank check to the board, to the system created, saying, okay, we can't do single-payer, but create what you think fulfills these principles. I oppose that. The reason I oppose that and why it's so significant, so I think that should be taken out of the bill. And specific alternatives should be adopted rather than this just general idea and put on their own bill. The reason this is so significant is because there are barriers to incorporating some public spending of healthcare in Minnesota into a state public pool. And these relate to federally regulated and federally funded programs, Medicare and Medicaid most of all. The bill calls for waivers and agreements, et cetera, but there are no single-payer waivers for Medicare and Medicaid. There isn't a single-payer waiver program that you can apply for. Medicare, to incorporate Medicare in a state public pool requires changes in the Medicare law, which is one of the most politically difficult things in this country. If Medicaid can be incorporated with some sort of other waiver, like an 1115, it's untested. Even if it could possibly be done, it's all subject to political approval. And so the President and Congress could block allowing any of these agreements. Since a system cannot be created by the state alone, by state legislation alone, this bill will fall back on this thing that says, if you can't get single payer, you'll be authorized to adopt these things. So that's a linchpin. What will happen if this bill is passed without federal approval is you'll fall back on this thing that says, create reforms consistent with these principles, which is an open, you know, sort of a blank check. There's not a lot of support in Congress for single payer. There are changes in law needed, perhaps some agency regulations would need to be changed rather than just to the extent of law. Like I say, all of that is subject to political approval and gamesmanship. The total amount of spending that can't be incorporated is 35% as of right now, without waivers, et cetera. Do you have 65% in one pool, but a duplicate pool of 35%, or multiple pools actually that duplicate all the health coverage in the state pool? That's not a single-payer system. On top of that 35%, there will be some degree of private spending.
Jealous.
It's not known yet. It really hasn't been estimated. It hasn't been figured into the cost projections. But the cost projections are not as applicable as one would think, because they do not include these two other types of spending. When I refer to single-payer policy dialogue, I am actually referring to proponents and opponents who are, you know, perhaps unintentionally or mostly unintentionally presenting misleading information. I put the emphasis here on supporters of single-payer and what's in the bill because we're looking at this bill. What's not being emphasized enough is the extent of which federal approval is needed. I don't think many people out there understand the gravity of that and what it means. And people are being told, get support this bill because if we pass it, we'll have single payer in Minnesota. Not true. If we pass it and we get massive federal approval, really the biggest health reform at the federal level ever, we'll get single payer. I myself have just within the past year come to have sort of done the math on all this stuff to have reached my conclusion. Prior to that, I've been pushing single-payer state legislation saying, let's get this, and glossing over the waiver issue, the federal approval issue. So I was misleading people unintentionally. On the other, so I think the debate needs to make that emphasis, but I think also the bill needs to emphasize this. There's a very small section that says waivers, exceptions, et cetera, will be sought. I think there should be legal due diligence that says this Medicare agreement is needed by changing this law. This waiver can be applied for, rather than just a basic, very generic statement. In terms of opponents of single payer, I've heard here in the last several minutes some very misunderstood and misleading statements. Once again, unintentionally, that I won't address unless I'm asked, and I'd be happy to, relating to what goes on in foreign nations, some of the ideas about socialism, government control problems in foreign nations, us having the best health system, and about talking about people coming to the United States and Minnesota to get health care. On that last point, I'll just say people coming to Minnesota is generally to come to the Mayo Clinic. It's one of the best health system hospitals in the world. You have very wealthy people from around the world coming to the Mayo Clinic. I'd be happy to answer any questions and expand on sort of the other side of the equation of problems that I see being presented in the dialogue in general. Thank you.
Mr. Schwartz, thank you. Senator Marty, I had not thought of the issues that Mr. Schwartz brings up, but I'm assuming you have some concerns as well about the waivers, and I don't know if you're considering changing that language. I certainly don't have anything to offer for you, but it seems to me he's making a valid point with that. I had some concern myself just about the board, and I don't have an amendment for that, but I know you're planning to, you have, I don't know how many stops you have, but I think that the conversation today has really been, it's been very helpful to me, and all the time you spent talking to me, it's, you know, I finally, I think, get it, and I kind of got down to more, I've been reading here as people have been talking and listening really hard, and I think that maybe we, you know, I know there's things that can still see some work. And I don't know, maybe you can comment. I was a little concerned about the board composition.
Sure.
And I don't know if you'd end up with only one doctor on there, but I sure want to make sure you have a gynecological oncologist on there. And and I mean it. So I'm, you know, being a little facetious, but not really. But that kind of thing. I would like to be sure that, you know, every area would be covered by that. But.
Madam Chair, a couple of comments. One on the makeup of the board. And yes, this bill would next go to state and local government where board makeup is kind of primary concern. Yes, I think what you have to recognize is a lot of health plans have a doctor or so on it. I think what you want is you want the feedback. You want everybody's advice and so on to be heard. The one thing that would be different about this where it wouldn't be as critical for your concern about a gynecological oncologist is the fact that this plan doesn't interfere with the doctor-patient decisions. That's the decisions would That's be true. Made by the oncologist and the patient, not by some insurance plan telling you what's covered and what's not covered and, well, this drug instead of that drug and so on, because I think that's key to the whole thing. To Mr. Schwartz's comment, I will say, yes, the bill does not gloss over that. We say we need federal exemptions, including legislation. I mean, I'm not glossing over that at all. It's a very major thing, and no state has done this. The trouble is we don't have a choice. We have to do this now. And when I mentioned that $20 billion growth above the $35 billion we're spending now, that's bigger than the entire state government, just the growth in our health care the next 7 years over what we can't afford now. I'd like to move the bill in a second, but I want to say that the analogy I'd like to make to this when people are talking, what's socialism, what's private market system and so on. Again, it's this is a system that we do have certain socialized services in our country. Police and fire is a good example. And I use police and fire as an example about health care in the sense that if you go home tonight and you find your home is being broken into, you use your cell phone, you call 911, and the police dispatcher gets on the phone and they don't ask you, do you have police insurance? What company do you have? Does it cover home burglary? They come to your house instead and they deal with it. And it's something some people need police protection. We all need it, but we may call on the police sometime in our lives. We may call on them frequently. Some need it more than others. You can't know. But the whole idea is we provide the service. It's something we all pay into. This is not free. It's not cheap. We think it's about 20% cheaper than the current system. Wilder Research is beginning to conduct a $300,000 study on the cost estimates of this bill. It's a major thing to calculate. It's something the state agencies wouldn't have the ability to do. It's a major, major task. But we think it will be significantly cheaper than what we're spending now. And those are ongoing savings because once you set up a system that works and you put in place early intervention, preventive care, public health, you, again, operate like police and fire. It's a lot more efficient than if we all had our own police companies that we can contract with.
Madam Chair.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, just I want to give a lot of credit to Senator Marty for bringing this forward. I'm not sure it's the perfect solution, but it is a roadmap to get there. And we heard in the Business, Economic, and Jobs Committee yesterday, the committee that I chair, and Senator Scheid and Senator Gerlach and
Senator Sparks.
Senator Sparks sit on that committee. And we had the business manufacturers in, and we also had Central States Business Community in. And certainly the business community. And their biggest driving cost is health care. And I guess I just want to make a point that instead of the chamber and the business partnership, just kind of out of the chute criticizing Senator Marty's initiative, I would think after all the testimony we heard yesterday in that committee, which took about 2.5 hours worth, And it came up over and over and over again, Senator Marty, the costs of health care. So now we come here in the business community. I don't know. I just think they should. They don't have to embrace your situation. But I think they should come forward with some ideas of their own. Because their community, the business community, and all of our community, of course, the business is part of all our interests. But they had to come up and say, here's how we can help, you know, the situation. So I guess that's just an observation after that long hearing yesterday, Senator Scheid, and that's their biggest concern, and then the chambers and others come up and just criticize some efforts. Well, at least we got some efforts that you're bringing forward and some others. So why don't we somehow between now and May something, unless people just say, no, we don't want to get along, why don't we try to get along? At least try. Bring the different factions in, and I know you've reached out for them, but I just kind of want to make that plea that, hey, like the late Senator Sam Solon used to say, well, go over there in the corner. If it takes you an hour, if it takes you 4 weeks, or it takes you 4 months, go work it out. If there's a little bit of help in some areas, a little pain in some areas, let's get to the finish line, okay? And we can't continue as a society, and I'm preaching a little too much, that what's driving, you know, this $5 billion debt that we have in the state? I mean, it's a big part of it is health care, the delivery of health care, and what the cities and the counties and all your local jurisdictions have to tax, you know, to pay for this stuff. So that's the end of my preaching. But I do think you've got to give some credit to Senator Marty for at least, I don't know if it's perfect. I'm not that expert yet, but we're going to get a few more months to look at this stuff. But and I'm sure there's a lot of work to be done, but at least thank you.
Senator Marty, will you ever be able to quantify costs or, you know, dollar amounts so that people have a target to, you know, to either oppose or say, hey, that isn't as bad as we thought it might be?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And this bill, I would love to have it move a lot further this year, but this is the second committee. We may get to another one. Realistically, this bill is not likely to pass this year. And as I mentioned, Wilder Research is committed to doing a $300,000 cost study of this, which is a major, major commitment. But I think they recognize the importance that we have to address this. I'm ready to make a motion unless there's more discussion.
Well, Senator Marty, is their study actually going to be to try to quantify and put for numbers?
How much this would cost.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Senator Vandiver, did you have a question or comment? Oh,
I did. Senator Marty, I missed some of the presentation, but we've talked about your bill before. I'm just wondering, the federal waivers I'm not really worried about because I think any reform that state would embark upon would require waivers, you know, from the federal government because they are the government in health care, and of course we'd have to get free of them before we put our own shackles on. Before we get to our glorious utopia. Mm-hmm. But have you figured out how we're going to keep people from coming here for the free health care?
They preach too much.
And, you know, there's a quote, I forget who said it. If you think health care is expensive now, wait till it's free. But people will be moving here for it. Do we have, if we're the only state with it, is there something in the plan to deal with that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Vandiver, good question, good point, and I know you had lots of. Your wording was a little different than I might put things because I don't think this is putting shackles on. I think it's taking shackles off. In terms of other states, yes, the bill does call for, again, it's not explicit how it would happen yet, but the board is required to put in place procedures to prevent people from doing that and to work with the federal government because, again, I'm not minimizing the federal requirements. My argument that would be one of the things that they'd have to be asking for in part of the waivers is to say, look, we're taking care of our Minnesotans' health care. If California or Wisconsin or some other state doesn't take care of all their people and they move here because of it, to let us charge back to those states because it's their problem and we should take care of our folks' health care, not theirs. But the bottom line is that that would require federal approval, and that's why I'm saying the health plan, I'm not trying to minimize that at all, because it would take federal legislation. And I frankly think that two things. One, I think a couple of states do this. I think the federal government won't have much choice but to do this. We can't sustain what we're doing.
Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think there is no question that we can't. We don't have affordability. We don't have portability. We do have to do something, and I commend you for what you've done, and I don't think it'll work. I haven't seen anywhere else it worked, but admittedly, something is going to have to happen because people can't continue the way they are. So either we come up with this or something better, but we need to reform it. So thank you for your efforts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Two final things before making the motion. One is I will encourage members to take a look at that PBS frontline show on other countries and so on. I think how Taiwan looked at what worked and what didn't work in the world, put it together. And I'd say that this bill is an attempt to go further than that and look at what they tried and what everybody's tried and what works best and system that works. I believe this is on the right track. But and also, Senator Metzen's right, working things out is very important. I will commit to meeting with business partnership anytime and talking about all this. And I think that's very important. I've been reaching out to every group that's willing to talk about it. So, and with that, I will move, first of all, a small amendment on page 7, line 24, before the period, insert in Minnesota. I made that correction when I was explaining the bill.
Senator Marty, where is it?
On page 7, line 24, before the period, insert in Minnesota.
So market the drugs to consumers in Minnesota.
Right. We can't nor should we try and stop them from marketing drugs in other states, whatever they want. And I'll move that first.
Senator Marty moves that amendment. Any questions or discussion? All those in favor of the Marty amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, I will move that Senate File 118 as amended be recorded pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Okay.
Roll call, Madam Chair.
A roll call has been requested, and Senator Marty moves that Senate File 118 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. There'll be a roll call, Senator Johnson. Is there any discussion? Then, if you would take the roll.
Scheid.
Aye.
Aye.
Sperla?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Marty?
Aye.
Metzen?
Aye.
Prettner-Solin?
Aye.
Scogan?
Aye.
Vandenberg?
No.
Me?
Oh, Senator Olson.
I'm excited to vote for this bill. I don't want to miss the opportunity. That's an aye.
So, and that is 7 voting aye, 3 voting no. The motion prevails, and the bill will be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations. Senator Marty, thank you for all the work, and thank you to everybody in this room who sat so quietly and patiently. Thank you to the members, and the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the